Good evening, and welcome to the March 2017 San Luis Obispo Health Commission meeting. We're glad you're all here with us. We didn't meet last month, and it seems like a long time since we've seen each other, right? We do have to approve our minutes from our January meeting. Did you all get a copy? And if so, anybody have any additions, corrections, anything we need to make changes on? Okay, hearing none, we will accept them as Jean has prepared them, and she'll put them on the website for review. This is the time in the program when we accept public comment. If there's anybody in the audience that desires to speak on any topic other than what we have on our schedule for this evening, they're welcome to step forward, and we'll be glad to hear their comment. And seeing no one get up, we'll go ahead and get started with our program this evening. So we're happy to have with us this evening our Environmental Health Services, and they're going to give us an update on our beach water quality program as well as the well program. That is a mouthful, isn't it? So I'd like to introduce Liz, who is division manager, and she will introduce her colleagues in the program.
Good evening, Chairwoman Sage and members of the commission. My name is Liz Posey-Bon. I'm the new Environmental Health Manager for the Environmental Health Services Division. I've been here for just over a year now. It's been great. And I'm very pleased to introduce our staff who are here today to provide an update on our beach water quality monitoring program and our well construction permitting program. We have Gina Herbst here. She is our GIS specialist. We call her our wizardess. She does such a fantastic job with GIS. We also have Leslie Terry, who is our new supervising environmental health specialist, replacing Rich Lechtenfels, who retired after 28 years of dedicated service. We're going to miss him, but we're very excited to have Leslie stepping forward into the new role. And I'd also like to introduce Liberty Amundson. She will be providing an update for our beach water quality monitoring program. She is our program lead, and also Jeremiah Damery. He is the lead for our well construction and permitting program. So now I would like to turn it over to our team to start the presentation.
All right, thank you. So we're going to start off with the well program, and we're going to go through some of the things that we've done most recently in the program. One of the things that we've done is we have records, well permit applications, and well completion reports that go back to the early 60s. So one of the things we've been working on is mapping all of those wells. So we've gone back to about 1990, and that is approximately 15,000 that we've mapped. And so we still have some work to do, so we're going back from 1990 back to like 1964, I think. So that's a work in progress, but it's been a good effort there. And one of the things hopefully we'll be able to do in the near future is we have all those well completion reports, and they used to be proprietary. The public didn't have access to them until a couple of years ago. The law changed. So one of the things that we're gonna do is have those well completion reports included in that map application, so that eventually you could look up a map or you look up a well on the map, and then you could click on it, and then a PDF of the well completion report could pop up, and so it'd be public. Public facing, you could access all of that. So that's right now, converting all those paper files and making that access or making that data more accessible to the public has been one of our projects. And quiz for you. Anyone want to guess the era from those pictures? We're going back. Any guesses? 1890s? It's close. Good. Yeah, I don't know. No, I'm sure. I found those. They're actually Tulare County, 1906. I think they're pretty interesting. And it kind of have a contrast with the next one. We'll move on here. This is kind of a modern setup here. And one of the things that's happened more recently, obviously, with our drought, wells being needing to be drilled somewhat deeper. So a specific example, you know, in the Paso Robles groundwater basin, sometimes someone might have a well that's 200 or 300 feet deep. Now, if they're getting a replacement well, oftentimes it might be, you know, 500 or 600 feet deep. So with these deeper wells being drilled, then it kind of, we needed to make sure that we had a process in place to make sure that the state standards were still being met. When wells are drilled a little bit deeper in the Paso Robles groundwater basin area, we have multiple aquifers that might be penetrated, and which is okay so long as the well is constructed properly and the aquifers are sealed off from each other so that there's not inner aquifer flow. And so we worked with the well drillers. We collaborated with them and local geologists to come up with some depth thresholds, to develop these depth thresholds. And we wanted to have a tool for them to be able to easily identify when they needed to get a geologist letter, when we needed to have that secondary review. So let's see what. So this is a static map of kind of, this is the Paso Robles groundwater basin. They're labeled, these sub area thresholds are labeled. So you can see, for example, the one in the middle that's kind of reddish, and it says Estrella 700 feet. So in that sub area, the driller would be able to identify, okay, if I'm going to drill there less than 700 feet, business as usual. If it's deeper than 700 feet, then I need to get a letter from a geologist so we have a better idea of what's happening down there. And then to make this, to have an interactive map so they could be able to work through this and have some tools, Gina, and this is all Gina's work, by the way. This is, so we have, these are some more screenshots of what the well driller view looks like, or driller view. And so I'm going to turn some time over to Gina so she can go through, and we'll go live, I think, to the driller view. Okay, Gina.
Okay, thank you, Jeremiah, and good evening, commission members. So driller view was specifically developed for well drillers to use in the field and in the office, and it is mobile friendly and public facing. And so the initial extent takes us to the Paso Robles groundwater basin with clearly delineated boundaries of the sub areas with those thresholds labeled. We have a home panel that briefly describes the application and gives us a quick start guide. We also have helpful links to outside agencies such as FEMA for flood zone codes, DWR, well completion reports, and also a link to our well permitting webpage. And we also offer a static map in case you want to work offline. And we also have a guide for mobile use and a guide for desktop use. This application incorporates countywide mapping layers, major roads and highways, water purveyors, the water service boundaries, cities and community service districts, the coastal zone, of course, the groundwater basin with the sub areas, and FEMA flood zones, and statewide topo map. And the last two layers here were actually suggestions made by the well drillers when we had a training workshop just for the well drillers to come and learn how to use the mapping application. We had a very successful turnout and some really great feedback from them. So we have a robust toolbar with some basic navigation tools. and some bookmarked locations. So these are predefined locations for the user to focus the map to a certain area. So we have all of the sub-areas in here. So if you want to focus just on the Creston sub-area, it will zoom you right there. You can also zoom to a specific city or community service district. I just did Aurora Grande. And there are coordinate tools. So anywhere on the map, you can actually can plot a coordinate value. And we have a coordinate toolbar down here. So the coordinate values will follow you wherever you move the cursor. We also have measuring tools, distance and area. We have sketching tools, which I'll demonstrate, for point lines and polygons, and also for adding text. And the user can also edit the text and graphics, erase, remove whatever they like, and start over. And there are three main ways to get to a proposed well site, and that is by either an assessor parcel number, an address, or coordinates. So I will demonstrate entering an APN. And from the results window, you just select it, and it will zoom you right into that parcel. It will highlight the parcel boundary and also give you smart labeling, so we know that this parcel is within the Estrella sub-area with a drilling threshold of 700 feet. We can also see clearly that this is the Paso Robles Water Department, the water service area, and the boundary for the city of Paso Robles as well. So to demonstrate some great tools that we can use, and one thing that's been helpful with this tool is to give the map drillers a means of creating a really great site map that is part of the well permit application. In the past, we have received, you know, hand-sketched maps, and this is kind of a nice standardized way to create a site map. So, for instance, if this area here, we're thinking about putting something in here. I don't know why this is getting so big. Okay, so here we go. So I'm going to focus on this western portion of the parcel. And you can very easily measure distances, and it'll give you a total area. And you can also add markers in here. So say that looks like a great site for a well. And you can, right there, you can add some text to that. And to finish it off, we can also give it coordinate values right on that spot, which is a requirement for the well permitting process. Now, from this, you can export to a PDF right away out in the field on your mobile device, and you can share this with the well drillers can share this with their staff, so they can actually create a PDF that is readily available and useful for the well permitting application. Okay, next I will get to a mapping site by an address. And again, I will select from the results window, and it'll zoom me in to this location. So for this address, this parcel is within the Estrella sub-area. It is also within the Independence Ranch CSD. And then, lastly, I will enter coordinates right into the search bar. So select the result, and again, you'll be zoomed in right to that coordinate. So that is, those are the basic applications for this tool. Are there any questions?
It's impressive.
Thank you.
And they can do this out in the field.
Yes, they can, on their phone or tablet. Absolutely.
Scott?
So is this a software product developed by Environmental Health, or is this a commercial product, proprietary, but
it is
created
by
Environmental Health? Okay.
It is a product that was purchased by the Enterprise GIS of the county, so we're not the only department that that has access to this tool, but you custom build it for your need. And you can make it public-facing, or you can make it just, like, say, within the county intranet, which we have HealthView, which I don't know if you remember, but I demonstrated that. And that is, we can configure it so that it's only available for the intranet, for the county intranet. But WellDriller is public-facing and available for everybody.
So what role does Environmental Health play in the whole well program?
So we issue all the permits for wells throughout the county. So if someone wants to drill a well in the county, then the permits are issued through Environmental Health, through our office.
I was wondering, with all this welcome rain that we've had in the last couple months, has that helped the groundwater situation, or does it take a long time for that to improve?
That's a good question. It probably depends on the area. I mean, some areas it might recharge a little bit quicker depending on the geology. But usually, typically, I think it's years before you would recognize a significant difference in most areas.
Okay. Thank you.
So I want to jump in and add to what our staff is saying about the well program. It is a little known fact. In fact, I didn't know it when we had a situation last year where toxins were found in a certain area and a number of the wells tested positive for a product that shouldn't be in our drinking water. Tell me if I'm stepping on anyone's toes. You're not going to talk about this. Okay, so we very proactively, developed an educational tool to tell well owners. Many of them might have bought a property 30, 50, 80 years old with an old well that they were using, and no one ever told them, you know, it's a good idea to check the water quality once in a while. So we did a massive outreach campaign to at least those that we know have wells based on the data that's in place, 15,000 since 1990, with some tips for homeowners that Environmental Health does not inspect private wells, that it's really up to the homeowner. And so that I'm using this as another opportunity to get that message out, that it is a really good idea for homeowners on some periodic basis, annually or what, okay, to check their well. We did a videotape starring our own Leslie Terry, and it's now available on our website. And we also are working through a change in the regulatory process to now have new wells at least have that initial well testing for contaminants in the well water when a new well is actually placed. So a lot of work has been going on. And to your question, Commissioner Klaus, about drought, we do think that we are possibly, or at least until last month, seeing a number of contaminants due to the drought that they may have been there all along, but with the dilutional effect during non-drought periods, that they were below detection or below a threshold level of concern. With the groundwater drying in some areas, we think that that may be part of the reason why we were starting to see higher levels of contaminants in some areas. So hopefully with the water will not just come additional water, but also that dilutional effect to prevent the intake of higher levels than are recommended for human health in terms of ingestion. So, thanks.
So you explained to me, Jeremiah, that you're involved in the permitting process. That's what environmental health does. And then we heard a little bit here that Dr. Bornstein was telling us. I'm curious, what is the role of environmental health in protecting the public health when it comes to wells?
Well, one of the main things is to protect the groundwater. So when wells are constructed, and this came up recently, is the multiple aquifers is a good example. If multiple aquifers are penetrated and one of the aquifers is of a lesser quality water, then we want to isolate that and not have it mix with a better quality aquifer. And then also to, you know, the typical things that are looked at for a well permit application is that it's, you know, not going to be too close to a septic tank or a leach field, or not too close to animal enclosures. You know, potential contamination sources that if they got down into the well, or, you know, into the borehole or into the casing, and then it's a direct conduit down to the groundwater. So that's one of our charges, is to, you know, protect that. And so those are some of the things that we look at too. Any other questions? Or we're gonna move on to the beach portion, and we can ask if you have other questions about the well program. We can come back to that if you want. Or okay. So now I will turn the time over to Liberty.
Thanks, Jeremiah. Good evening, commission members. I'm going to give you a brief overview of our beach water quality program. Our beach water quality program is a grant-funded program. It's funded in its entirety by a grant from the state of California. And in exchange for those grant funds, we have two main responsibilities. One is testing for bacteria levels at beaches that meet the state sampling criteria. And the second is to provide the public with the results of those testing and to notify. So the way that we notify the public is via posting warning signs at our beaches if we happen to have an advisory, also by maintaining our webpage, which Gina is going to show you shortly. And then we also maintain a water quality hotline that the public can call in to get information anytime if they don't have access to the internet. So we're currently sampling 19 locations along the coast, from Hearst State Beach in the north to Oceano Dunes State Vehicular Recreation Area in the south. We do this on a weekly basis, and we do year-round sampling, so we sample in both wet weather and dry weather conditions. A new requirement for our grant funding that went into effect this year is something called zero-point sampling. Zero-point sampling is actually sampling directly at the source of potential contamination. So if there's a creek outfall or a storm drain outfall, they want us sampling right where that water meets the ocean water. And that caused us to shift two of our sampling locations, one at Avila Beach and one at Cayucas Beach. So now in those locations, we're sampling directly at the creek outfall. And over time, that will give us a good idea of the water quality that's coming into our beaches from those creeks. So what are we looking for? Environmental Health Services goes out and samples 19 locations. We take those samples back to our public health lab, and they're looking for three different types of fecal indicator bacteria. Fecal indicator bacteria are used statewide because they actually indicate the presence of bacteria or viruses that could be harmful to human health. They're used because they're relatively inexpensive to test for and also fairly rapid. Our sample results take 24 hours to process. The state has bacteriological standard concentrations for each of the three types of fecal indicator bacteria. There are exceedance levels. So if a single sample exceeds one or more of those three test types, then a health advisory is issued at that location. When we issue a health advisory, we actually physically post the beach with our advisory signs warning the public to avoid water contact in that area due to elevated levels of bacteria. We also update our website and our hotline, and then we continue to resample that location until we get a sample back that's below the state bacteriological limits. We issue three main types of advisories at Environmental Health: the health advisory, which is a bacteriological standards exceedance, to what I just explained. Another one that we can issue, which we've been doing quite a bit of lately, is a countywide rain advisory, and those are typically issued in lieu of sampling. We expect bacteria levels to be high due to stormwater runoff, so we'll issue a rain advisory, and that advises the public to avoid water contact during and 72 hours following a rain event. The other type of advisory that we can issue is actually a beach closure, and we will issue a closure when there's a sewage spill or a hazardous materials release onto one of our beaches. We physically post the beach when this occurs. The language on our signage is stronger. Ocean water contact activities are prohibited during that time. We'll work with local lifeguards or, you know, park rangers to help us keep the public out of the water during a beach closure. And just like a health advisory, we will continue to sample that location until we get a sample that's below the state bacteriological limits. So in addition to posting, updating our website and our hotline, when we close the beach, we also issue a press release. So, of course, regardless of the cause of the elevated levels of bacteria, there are health impacts from contacting or ingesting the water. No one ever purposely ingests ocean water, but it happens sometimes when you're surfing or swimming. And that can result in gastrointestinal illness or flu-like symptoms. Recreating in high levels of bacteria can cause upper respiratory infections or ear, nose, and throat issues. And then the other thing that we advise the public is to avoid water contact and avoid contact with wet sand, because this has been associated with skin infections. We realize that there are economic impacts when our beaches are posted. We're a tourist economy. We were joking earlier. I said when our beaches make our local news, they make the news in the Central Valley as well. I know this because I have family there, and they call me and say, what's happening at the beaches? So it gets a lot of attention. So we work really closely with our local regulators to try to minimize the number of advisories and closures. We'll work with cities, state parks, county parks, typically by assisting with grant funding. A lot of times they'll be looking to do beach studies or some kind of beach improvement, and so we can help provide historical data or current beach data or even support letters for grants. We also work very closely with local stakeholders like Surf Rider Foundation, Heal the Bay. We attend beach water quality working group meetings locally and also statewide to help maintain our water quality here in San Luis Obispo County and also improve that. So just some current stats. This year to date, it's been a very busy year. When it's rainy in our county, you can bet that we're busy in our beach program. We've issued 15 health advisories. We've had four countywide rain advisories, and we've had three locations closed due to sewage spills. As I mentioned, one of the best ways for the public to get information about our program and the current status of the beaches is through our county beach website, and we're very proud of our new URL, which is surfsafeslow.org. I don't know if you visited our old URL, but it was a mouthful. So this is very exciting for us. And Gina is going to take you over to our website and show you some of the new improvements that she's made there.
Okay, so we are at the Environmental Health Services Beach Water Quality webpage. And this is where the public can see the current alerts and advisories, and also have a link to our interactive map to show current conditions at the beaches. Again, this is a very mobile-friendly app that you can use at the beach. And the symbols are currently all green. That means all the beaches are open. We have orange for a health advisory, red for a closed beach, and a rain cloud symbol for rain advisory. And I don't know if you can tell, but these are water beakers. Okay. So there are different ways that you can get information about a site. You can just click directly on a sample station, and from there you'll get the actual description of the sample location. And you can also view additional information, which is new to the site. We've added 3 years of historical beach water quality data, including event days for health advisories and rain events and closures. So you just scroll down and you can see 3 years worth of information there. You can go ahead and you can just type in a beach area that you would like to visit. So if you type in Avila, you will get all the sampling locations in Avila. You click the one of your choice and it'll, bam, take you right there. We also recently added inactive beach water sampling sites. So for instance, in Avila, AB9 became inactivated, and then we created AB10, which is the zero-point sampling location. So that replaced the sampling site. But if you would like to see historical information about the old site, you can click on it, view additional details, and that will offer you 2014 through 2016 worth of information. We also have bookmarks of predefined locations, so you can jump to a beach area by selecting one to Pismo, and then again click on the site to get more information. So that concludes my demo. Do you have any questions?
Sure. Bob? You talked about the state standards for those three categories. And if those are exceeded, what's done to improve that? Do you guys do something to improve that? Do you have to look for the source? What happens?
Okay, so that's a good question, and that's a question a lot of people have. Environmental Health Services is charged with sampling and notifying, so we don't do any sort of source identification studies. That will fall on whoever has jurisdiction for that particular location. And that's when we try to step in and help with grant funding for source identification studies or providing historical data or even writing grant support letters to get them funds so that they can do their own study, because it falls back onto the jurisdiction if it's a city, state park, county park. Environmental health, we sample and we notify.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You've mentioned grant funding a number of times. Where do these grants come from? And in particular, are you at risk of losing any federal funds these days?
Well, I'll tell you that currently we aren't receiving any federal funds. So historically, the program was funded in thirds, really. A third of our funding came from a federal grant, a third of our funding came from a state grant, and then a third of our funding came from county general fund dollars. So for the past two fiscal years, the state of California has funded our program in its entirety. So we're not relying on any federal funds or any county general fund dollars at this time. And it looks like that will be continued into the future.
Good news.
I know, great news.
So the sampling sites, mm-hmm. how do you decide on a site? And when you close a site and put it someplace else, why is that?
Okay. So the state actually determines the criteria for a sampling site. It has to have at least 100,000 annual visitors, and it has to have a source of contamination, and it also has to have easy public access. So the sampling sites are kind of already outlined by the state. When we shifted our site, it was because of that zero-point sampling. So we were sampling in that area, but further away from the creek. And that's kind of what had been done historically in counties along the coast, 50 yards or so away from the creek to see the impact of the ocean water, but not necessarily the impact of the creek water. And that's why the state has shifted more to the zero-point sampling. They want to know what's happening right at that interface where the creek or the storm drain meets the ocean water there.
We are taped and going live. There's a video playing right now of what we're saying, and mm-hmm. so let's do a little marketing for you. So
okay.
What's the phone number, the hotline?
It's on our website. Gina, can you scroll up for me?
Sure. So, right here?
No, that's our general line.
Oh, I see up here. Let's see.
It's on there.
Is there a hotline number on here?
Can you say it out loud for the folks at home?
We're going to. Thank you.
Counselor. Oh, and real quick, I wanted to, I failed to mention, we do have links to the last 30 days of testing results. Totally forgot to show that. And this lists all of the sites as well. And we have sites, links to the National Weather Service, Surfrider, Surfline, and the Buoy Report. And Penny, you wanted me to go to Surfline?
Guessing where a hotline might be.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't see it on there. I believe it's 805-781-3411, but I'll double check that.
Okay, and continuing in this sort of marketing for you,
yes.
What's the name of this website we're going to?
SurfSafeSlow.org.
SurfSafeSlow.org. Okay,
yes.
Great. What kind of information can a person expect if they go to this phone number and there's 19 locations? What are they hearing when they play that?
So when you call and there's no advisories, which is what we're always hoping for, that's typically what you're going to hear when you call. It's me recorded saying that there are no posted advisories at this time. We always warn people, especially during our rainy season, to avoid water contact during rain events and 72 hours following rain events. If we do have an advisory, then it'll tell you the location of the advisory, and we update that daily. So anytime you call, you'll either get no advisory or the location of the advisory.
So if there is an advisory, are we telling people what is that advisory other than just don't go use it? You know, are we being specific?
Yeah, so it will be a health advisory or a rain advisory or a beach closure.
Okay. But we don't get into the technical names for what's been detected there or anything like that?
No, we don't. We don't talk about the fecal indicator bacteria because, again, to stress, those are just an indication of what could potentially be there.
Okay.
We don't do specific testing, so we don't know if it's a human source or an animal source.
Hmm.
We just know that triggers that response that we need to be protective of public health.
Okay. My last question, just showing my ignorance, kind of naive, but it just popped into my mind, is I already know about the part of when storms happen and rivers are feeding things down to the beaches. That's really an issue. What about elephant seal areas?
Yeah, well, that's part of why when there seems to be recurring issues at beaches, then you want to get into applying for some funds to do some kind of source identification study. Mm-hmm. So you want to know if it's a human source, because that's the greatest risk to public health, if it's a human source. And then it's nice if you can identify, if it's a non-human source, what source of that, what source is that? And then the final question you want to answer when you know the source is then what impact does that have on human health? So if elephant seals cause our bacteria levels to go up, what is the real, you know, health impact for beachgoers?
I see. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Any last comments for us? Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
So we'll turn to Dr. Borenstein for the public health report next.
Sorry, I'm confusing a mouse and a microphone here.
Good to see. We all.
Okay. Thanks. I have a number of optimistic things to share with you tonight in the way of funding coming from a couple of different sources. And I know in the past, in fact, your commission sent a letter of support on behalf of our Dental Transformation Initiative application as part of the Medicaid waiver to the state of California. 15 counties were selected, and ours was one of them, I'm happy to report. It seems like great news, but we have we received that notice almost a month ago, and we still can't tell you how much funding we're going to get or exactly for what. So it's an ongoing iterative process with the State Department of Healthcare Services to fine-tune exactly what the program is going to look like. We do know, unfortunately, one of the major components that we were hoping to include has been excluded, and that is the inclusion of private practices in a Dentical incentive opportunity. But we are going to get funding for a virtual dental home, which I think Dr. Fardanesh talked to you about, where we can have extended mid-level providers, dental hygienists working at schools or other places within communities and doing initial screenings and some prophylaxis and education, and then work virtually, sort of teledentistry, to have a dentist look at x-rays and actual pictures of the mouth and make recommendations about next steps. So we're working with Tolosa and community health centers. Both have now been given the opportunity to expand that part of the project. We did get the stipends to assist with workforce development. Particularly, we requested for dental hygienists to actually take the exam to certify them as registered dental hygienists, which allows them to do more things in a private dental office or any dental office. So that is a great opportunity. And also, we're being given the opportunity to expand stipends to registered dental hygienists to become advanced practice RDH. So we're looking into the opportunity for that and how it might work in our county. So that's, I think, all good news. I know I'm being a little skittish because it's been a very interesting process to get notified of an award and told you need to get the contract to the board tomorrow, but then we've been engaged in weeks worth of teleconferencing over exactly what the details of this initiative are going to look like. Also, with regard to increased funding for oral health, the Proposition 56, which passed in the 2016 voter initiative, is the $2 a pack increased tax on tobacco products as well as e-cigarettes, and that is providing a funding source for a number of different areas, but particularly how it will affect us at the county level is the development of an oral health state plan that will have an allocation formula to go to counties that are doing dental work. And by dental work, I don't mean necessarily, it sounds like, you know, crowns and root canals when you talk about dental work, but really outreach and system development and trying to create a broader platform for universal access to dental health care. So we should be seeing some additional funding in that regard as well. And also from the Prop 56, there will be a fairly sizable increase in our tobacco control program. So I don't know if that's news to our tobacco control chair. Probably not. I think that was discussed at your last meeting. But we are going to be provided the opportunity to do more of the menu of options that our existing funding has allowed for. Each county has to develop a local plan. So in a perfect world, if we had all the funding that would meet a best practice tobacco control plan, there's five components. There's community outreach and education. There's sales to minor, there's cessation opportunities, there's school-based opportunities. There's a multi-page document from the Centers for Disease Control that details what a best practice tobacco control program would look like. Nary a county around the country has been able to attain that with their existing funding. I'm not sure that this is going to get us there, but it will go quite a ways further in supplementing our ability to tackle some of those areas that we have not really been able to get into as of yet. Stay tuned. We expect we'll get probably at least a couple of health education positions, health educator positions from that, and maybe even a higher level position to manage all the different components that we will be involved with. Related to that, you may have seen or heard something on the news that we just did our triennial healthy Stores for Healthy Communities. This is a broad-based sample of, I think in our county, we hit like 78 stores. And what is being looked for as part of that survey in stores is advertising on the front window, availability of certain products, and placement of those products within the store. So this could be anything from a big supermarket to a corner store in a small community, gas station, mini mart. So a wide range of places that people can go to pick up their daily bread and sundries. Having the opportunity to see trend, this is only the second time that it's been done. Sadly, we haven't seen much in the way of improvement, and in some areas we've seen even more access to youth, especially of certain products. And by that I mean, you know, one statistic that stood out to me is that stores that were surveyed within, I don't remember the distance, 100, 500 feet of a school, there was universal 100% of stores that fell into that category sell candy-flavored tobacco products, whereas in the county at large, it was only 80%. So it tells you that there's real targeting of a market in youth to uptake these products. Similarly, e-cigarettes are widely available. Going back to the candy-flavored products, those are also, you know, the placement is important. They're at eye level for children. They're right near checkout. So for an impulse buy, those are the kinds of things that we looked at. Lots more alcohol available than healthy food choices. So our work is still cut out for us. One new aspect of the survey this year that was not included previously was condom availability. And that's very important because our rates, not just in this county, in the state, nationally, we are continuing to see an increase in our sexually transmitted infection rates. And so it's important for condoms as a means of prevention to be available. And while availability among stores was fairly high at about 80%, about 60% are available without having to go through a gain access to a locked part of the store where you have to actually ask. And certainly that makes youth use and purchase probably a little less viable in some cases. So that's a short summary. We will have the entire report available to you and on our website. But I just wanted to hit some of the highlights of that important survey. Lastly, I would like to mention and thank our staff who are still in the throes of implementation of our electronic health record, though they're all coming out and entering the healing stages. But I know I've been talking to you over time that we were moving toward getting out of the paper medical charting system, and we did pull that Band-Aid off in the last week of January for some of our clinical programs. We went live with our reproductive health clinics, and that encompasses family planning, pregnancy testing, STD testing, diagnosis and treatment, our immunization services, our tuberculosis clinical care and testing, and our communicable disease reporting of the wide range of disease reports that are mandatory reportable. And also the last program was SART, our suspected abuse response team program. So if you see some of our staff looking a little forlorn and dazed, I know we have some health providers here whose industries have been down that path long before we have. We're one of the latest, but we are very excited about the opportunities that this presents. One for space, if I could be so mundane, all the file cabinets. But secondly, the ease with which we hope to be able to pull out data. So, you know, the number of encounters of certain types and by demographics of patients and things. And ultimately, the long-term vision being connectivity to other healthcare providers for purposes of real-time sharing of records. So there's a lot of opportunities on the horizon. We delayed the implementation in three areas that we're hoping for a May or June start date. And the biggest one of those is our jail medical care system. And that's because we do nearly 50,000 visits in that system, and we can't get it wrong. And we deliver medications to a couple of hundred people two or three times a day. And so we let some of our, you know, busy but a little bit less robust programs go through the testing and working out all the kinks, and then we hope to come back to that program, as well as our medically indigent services program and our medical therapy, occupational therapy, and physical therapy for our California Children's Services. So those should be coming in sometime toward the end of our fiscal year. And that is my report. Open to any questions.
Thank you. Anybody have questions? Go ahead, Claire, and then Scott.
They'll love it. Once you get used to it, it changes your life.
Yeah.
So there's been an awful lot of media information about the subject of illegal immigration, and I'm certainly not here to stir up that topic. But I was impressed there was in our local newspaper a recent article about illegal immigrants having access to public education. And they were talking about the fact that they're actually having forums at the K through 12 schools to make sure that children feel safe there. They were told them to feel safe. They had the sheriffs there to reassure them that, you know, they're not there to question, you know, their immigration status. But it made me curious, what about public health department? When one uses services there, is there an issue with being a resident, being a citizen, any of that?
With the exception of paying for health care through our medically indigent services program, which is not inclusive of undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants, we have never done, we've never required proof of citizenship or green card or legal residence in our county for most of our public health services, well, pretty much for all of them. The reason for that is they're public health services, so it doesn't serve our community well to not take care of all of our residents when it comes to especially communicable diseases that can be transmitted, vaccine-preventable diseases, and so on. So we have continuously been providing care. We do get reimbursement if they have a third-party payer, and we charge for services unless it's at our request because we're doing an investigation of a case of disease.
And just specifically, do they have to be a resident of this county, or can someone who's just traveling through or whatever? Is there any status required that way?
Yeah, again, we don't require proof of residency, but I can tell you from what we see in terms of what is provided in terms of residency, we have very little, if any, out-of-county residents. You know, there might be travelers, tourists, visitors, long-term stays, but I don't think people are necessarily rushing to this county to get their pap smear, for instance. Or, I mean, I don't mean to be glib about that, but it's not a major issue. And if it is, it's probably reciprocal with neighboring counties. But I'm not sure that we've actually definitively looked at, you know, is there a percentage of our total user population that is out of county? But I would imagine it would be on the very low side.
Thank you for the report. Now let's have health commissioner updates. David, let's start with you. Jean?
The Adult Services Policy Council did meet last Friday, and it was very interesting because Lynn Compton, one of the board supervisors, came and described all the things that they're doing on the board of supervisors, which was kind of enlightening when you think about Adult Services Council. So you want to know exactly what's available, and she heard from us things that we were looking for, so it was good dialogue.
Scott?
No report.
We're still working on the letter for the board for the with regard to the Napomo Dunes, and still waiting on the results of the modeling system that the California Air Resources Board and our APCD, with a degree of cooperation from state parks, is putting together, and Larry Allen tells me they'll have some early and significant results anytime soon. I'm hoping in the next few weeks, but I know I've been singing that song for a few months now.
No report.
Okay, I have just a couple. The Healthy Communities Work Group had an excellent presentation earlier this month by students from the planning program at Cal Poly. They've worked with three of the communities in our county, Arroyo Grande, Pismo Beach, and Atascadero. And at some point, I would like to have them here to the commission to go over their findings with us. It's called Healthy Places, Healthy People. But they had some interesting statistics and recommendations and so forth. We're working very hard to get the cities to do health and all of the policies as they set them for the cities. So hopefully we can have them here soon and you all can hear the program as well. The other, Chris, who isn't here this evening, but she and I have been working on the Preventing Health Grant, CBO, grant applications. We've reviewed them, doing site visits this week, and I think although we don't know how much money we have yet to work with, we will be funding next week sometime, and then that will, of course, go to the Board of Supervisors, and they'll discuss it during their budget hearings in June. And that's all I have. Committee reports. Budget, legislative, community education. And Claire, I think the nominating committee has met.
The nominating committee met in, January, I think. And we have an excellent candidate for our direct provider position, Gina Byram, who's here in the audience. Thank you for coming. So we would like to recommend that she be nominated to serve on the County Health Commission in the direct provider category and that her nomination be forwarded to the Board of Supervisors for final approval.
Do I have a motion to that?
I'll so move.
Okay. Second, anyone?
I'll second it.
Okay. Any discussion from anyone? All right, I think all those in favor, we can just signify by saying aye.
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 Okay.
All right, congratulations, Gina. Not quite there yet, but it'll go to the Board of Supervisors, and hopefully next month we'll have you up here among us. So we're looking forward to it. Anything from anybody else about prospective topics? Next month we will have... our topic is tobacco and vaping, and Kathleen Carley will be here along with her team. To tell us about that. And I think then we'll look forward to the remaining months of this. We're actually almost near the end of our year when you start to realize it. So. I think that brings us to the conclusion. Oh, Jean, go ahead.
I have one more announcement. At the Adult Services Policy Council, Joyce Allen Lippman did make the announcement that May is the Older Americans Month, and we are looking for people who have served the older adult in our community. So if anyone's interested in nominating people that have been provided services for the, you know, the population, it's the different nominated, their Senior Citizen of the Year, Public Official of the Year, Caregiver of the Year, Older Worker of the Year, Media Advocate of the Year, Senior Citizen Program of the Year. And so there's a lot of avenues, and we want to honor all the older adults that are giving back, as well as people that are helping our older America, our older county member here. So it's one of those things you can go online, and that's through the Commission for Senior Citizens, and that's open through April the 28th. So if you want to go online and recommend somebody, nominate them.
Thank you. So if anybody knows of someone they would like to nominate, please do so. All right. I think unless somebody else has anything at all to say, that brings us to the end of our meeting for this month, and we will stand adjourned.